I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect Podcast, where we speak to the brightest minds and talk about the ideas that matter in politics, arts and society. I'm Ellen Halliday, Deputy Editor at Prospect, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Simona Fulton, who's an independent filmmaker and journalist covering the Middle East. Simona wrote a really interesting reported piece for us in our latest issue of Prospect about Hezbollah in Lebanon and why they haven't yet been drawn into an all-out war with Israel. Today she's joining us to discuss that piece, but also the wider dynamics in the Middle East. Simona, it's lovely to have you with us. Where are you speaking to us from?
Thank you for having me, Ellen. I am currently in Austria.
And it was a few weeks ago now that you were in Lebanon reporting for us on what felt like quite a tense situation there in the weeks after Israel's ground invasion of Gaza began. Can you tell us a bit about what the mood was when you were in Lebanon at that time and what really you were hoping to understand?
Right. So very quickly after the war in Gaza began, and in fact, almost immediately after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, there was a fear in Lebanon that this would be potentially the first place where the conflict would spill over. So people immediately looked towards Hezbollah, which is the paramilitary group that is very powerful and, you know, is described as the de facto state in Lebanon because, you know, besides having a very powerful military wing, it also plays an important role in politics and society. So many were looking towards Hezbollah's reaction, whether it would enter the war. And indeed, within 24 hours on October 8th, Hezbollah sent the first barrage of rockets into Israel. It was a very carefully calibrated message targeting the Sheba farms, which are a disputed territory that is currently occupied by Israel. And that attack aimed to signal Hezbollah's support for Hamas. Now, Hezbollah and Hamas are both part of what we call, or what is called, the axis of resistance. And this is a loose alliance of state and non-state actors, including Hezbollah, Hamas, armed groups in Iraq, as well as Syria, the Houthis in Yemen, as well as Iran and Syria. And so the message that Hezbollah was sending is that it is backing its ally Hamas in the immediate aftermath of its attack on Israel. Now, that was a very clear message, but it was also a rather limited attack targeting these disputed territories which Lebanon is laying a claim to. And as we saw in the days after, Hezbollah didn't really want to fully escalate this conflict. It wanted to show its support for Hamas. It wanted to, as its chief Hassan Nasrallah said in one of his speeches, it wanted to distract the Israeli army by having to fight on two fronts simultaneously. But what we saw in the days after was that there were gradually escalating tit-for-tat attacks along what is called the Blue Line, which is the UN demarcated border that separates Lebanon and Israel. It is, in fact, not a border. It is the withdrawal line for the Israeli army from the last time when Lebanon and Israel were at war. That border still remains to be demarcated, but essentially the clash is very much focused around that blue line initially, and it kind of reassured people initially that perhaps this conflict was not going to escalate, that it would remain in line with the so-called unwritten rules of engagement that had kind of been in place since the last war in 2006, which was that both sides would only target military installations and personnel, and that those attacks would remain within 5 kilometers of the blue line. So that's kind of like what we saw initially, but very quickly, those rules of engagement were being challenged and pushed. And we started to see civilian casualties. Initially on the Lebanese side, we saw a Lebanese journalist, Issam Abdallah, being killed by an Israeli tank shell in what rights groups said was a deliberate targeting. We saw also the killing of other Lebanese civilians. And in response, Hezbollah then also began targeting civilians. We also saw the strikes from the Israeli side going deeper and deeper into Lebanese territory, which signaled a certain widening of the conflict. And, you know, with each of these strikes, there was this sense that the country would hold its breath and wait for Hezbollah's response, wait to see what is the red line, because the red line has not been very clearly declared. I mean, yes, Nasrallah has in the past said that if there was targeting assassinations or targeting of Hamas leaders or Lebanese, that there would be a retaliation escalation. But, you know, as we saw the conflict escalate, it felt like it wasn't entirely clear what the action would be that would push Hezbollah into all-out war. And there was also, interestingly, when I spoke to Lebanese officials who were not part of Hezbollah, the way they read Hezbollah's response is that they're actually trying to be rational, that they're showing relative restraint, because there is a number of factors playing into their decision-making, right? So sure, Hamas is one of their allies, they're ideologically aligned, they have a similar position towards Israel, but there are also a lot of domestic interests that are guiding Hezbollah's decision-making. And one of them is that, first of all, the Lebanese economy is not doing well at all since 2019, when essentially the financial sector collapsed. And with that came essentially a lot of challenges in everyday life in terms of operating the economy, getting electricity, getting money out of the banks. And so people are at a point where they feel like they cannot bear more, that a conflict would simply add further pressure that they cannot sustain. And Hezbollah is very much aware of that, because it doesn't want to lose its support and legitimacy domestically. And also it doesn't want to ignite internal strife with other components of Lebanon's very diverse society. So essentially, you know, all of this was kind of factoring into Hezbollah's decision making. And I think there was a key speech beginning of November in which Hassan Nasrallah said that, you know, it is supporting Hamas, but that the primary burden of fighting Israel had to remain on Hamas's shoulders. So the message was very clear. But what we've seen since then is that, you know, it has felt to people watching from Lebanon that it is in fact Israel that is trying to push Hezbollah into a war, that is trying to escalate. And the way this has been justified by some Lebanese officials is that this might be, you know, a good opportunity to try to challenge Hezbollah, which would politically serve especially Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. That's how this is explained by Lebanese officials. So this was very much kind of the sentiment in Lebanon at that time, this kind of fear on one hand, but also kind of then analyzing and looking at Hezbollah's actions and hoping that they will not drag the country into another war.
So, I mean, in your reporting, you mentioned the word restraint there and also here. And that's kind of the picture that you saw a few weeks ago was, as you say, a country that doesn't actually necessarily need that extra period of instability, the great, you know, unsettling that an all-out war would cause for the Lebanese people as well. I mean, since you reported that, we've seen some other kind of flashpoints emerge and become much more concerning elsewhere in the Middle East, notably, of course, in the Red Sea. Where else are you looking now in the Middle East as sort of the potential flashpoints for escalation if Hezbollah does, you know, perhaps hold its nerve, if that's the right way to say it, or, you know, hold on to that restraint?
So Hezbollah is the most powerful actor in this so-called axis of resistance. And, you know, some people would even argue that it is the one taking the lead after the United States has assassinated Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad in 2020. Soleimani was this, you know, very charismatic and powerful figure who really invested a lot in expanding and building this network of aligned actors in the region. And with his demise, it was very difficult to replace him with a person who could extend the same kind of influence. So Hezbollah's role became more important, and a lot of these actors in the region are in fact looking to Hezbollah for guidance. So when Hassan Nasrallah, for example, in one of his speeches, he really dedicated a lot of time in his speech on Hezbollah's Martyrs Day in November to lauding the actions of the other armed groups in this axis of resistance. He mentioned the Houthis, he mentioned the Iraqi armed groups who are launching attacks in both Iraq and Syria, targeting American forces. And so you can also sense from his side that he's kind of taking on this leadership role, encouraging the resistance groups across the region to take greater action. And I think it's really important to talk about why they're doing this. I think when you look at Western media coverage, all too often these actors are reduced to Iranian proxies. A lot of them are designated by the United States as terrorist organizations, so they will be referred to as such. And I think that is problematic because it really discounts them to, you know, these actors who commit violence for the sake of violence, who don't really have interests of their own and who just act at Tehran's behest. And that's an extremely simplistic picture, because if that's the kind of approach you're taking to understanding them, that it means that you can't also come up with the right solution to this conflict because you don't actually understand what drives them. So I think it's important to talk about that a little bit. So who are these actors, right? And what is driving their decision-making and their involvement? So I think, you know, when we look at Iraq, for example, there you have the so-called Iraqi resistance groups, and the most powerful of them is Kataib Hezbollah. And this group sprang up in response to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. So it has its roots in fighting occupation, in fighting what they see as negative Western influence in the region. And so when they look at Israel and what Israel is doing in Gaza, for them, it's very much connected. It is a different side of the same coin. So it really kind of, you know, Western support for Israel and its military operations in Gaza, which have by now killed more than 20,000 people, really brings back these memories from the Iraq war and the really bloody aftermath that claimed hundreds of thousands of lives in Iraq. So there is some genuine solidarity. There is no doubt about it. And, you know, that doesn't mean that there are not also other political motivations. For sure, you know, these groups, they also want to, you know, show that they are, you know, resisting. They want to bolster their resistance credentials and essentially also like rally their troops and show their constituents that we are standing up to the West and to the Americans and to Israel. So there is definitely a political side of it, but that doesn't mean that there is not a genuine empathy, sympathy for Palestinians. And I think if we look to their statements, so since these groups began attacking American troops again after the October 7th attack, and that was after a year of relative quiet in Iraq, it was a sudden end to a year-long truce, they began publishing statements in a very united way. You know, previously it had been rather fragmented, but they created a dedicated Telegram channel and started publishing these statements in which they claimed responsibility for these attacks very clearly. And in each and every statement, they write, responding to the massacres committed against our brethren in Gaza. So this is very clear. And the Houthis have been saying very similar things. Whenever they, in Yemen or in the Red Sea, attack commercial ships, they also claim responsibility, saying that this is in response to, for example, Israel's siege on Gaza. So, you know, it's interesting because in the beginning, we had some U.S. officials, I believe it was the defense secretary, who in the very beginning denied any links between the attacks in Iraq and what is going on in Gaza. And that is simply not true. Now, of course, there is also political interest, as I mentioned, and I think the big question here is to what extent Iran is directing these groups. And I don't think that's something that's very well understood. There is no doubt that Iran has helped create these groups, that it has helped train them, that it has helped arm them, especially in the beginning. This is also the case with Lebanese Hezbollah. But if we look at, for example, the Iraqi groups, Iraq is a very rich country. It is one of the biggest oil exporters in the world. And groups like Qatayb Hezbollah have used their military power to commandeer a significant part of the economy. And I've spoken with Qatayb Hezbollah officials in the past who have told me that they no longer need Iranian support. And I think that there's a very good chance that this is true, that in fact the financial flow might be going the other way around from Iraq to Iran, especially since the country has been under sanctions. But of course, there is very much an ideological alignment, right? They see eye to eye with Tehran. They have the same outlook on the region. They have the same outlook on the West. But whether Iran is giving the orders here, I have a doubt about that. I think these actors very much act on also their individual domestic interests. And sometimes they align and sometimes they don't.
After the break, we'll talk more about rising tensions in the Middle East and possible avenues to de-escalation. But first, I'd like to tell you about a new offer. Enjoy 1 month's free trial to Prospect's digital content and get full access to rigorously fact-checked, truly independent analysis and perspectives. There's no commitment and you can cancel at any time. To take advantage of this great deal, please search for Prospect 1 month free trial.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'll offer. Where does all of this leave the US in particular and how it's going to respond to these attacks? At the moment, it seems the precise nature of the US response is a little unclear as we speak. So how do you see the kind of Western reaction unfolding, particularly that of the United States?
I think that's an excellent question, because we have seen the US try to get involved to avoid an escalation, a regional escalation and an all-out war. So the US has made it very clear to Israel that it does not want this to spill over and to escalate. And we have also seen American officials traveling to Lebanon, trying to pressure the Lebanese government to rein in Hezbollah, trying to pressure the Iraqi government to rein in those groups. But, you know, this approach really fails to recognize the root cause of the problem, because the reason why these groups are responding the way they are is because of what Israel is doing in Gaza. So what they want is that these attacks will stop the moment there is a ceasefire in Gaza. That is their demand, and they've made this very clear. Instead, what the United States is doing, first of all, it is responding by bombing these groups, which it says is self-defense. Now, you could really, it's really kind of a stretch to try to justify how bombing the Houthis in Yemen is self-defense for the United States, because, you know, in the end, the only thing that does is to harden their attitudes and to further escalate the conflict. Because what these groups feel is that the United States is not understanding or refusing to understand why they're doing what they're doing. And they're just essentially layering grievance upon grievance instead of addressing the root cause of the problem. So, you know, we have now seen in Iraq most recently that Kataib Hezbollah, you know, after one of its attacks or one of the attacks of the Iraqi resistance, we're not exactly sure which group it was, but Kataib Hezbollah has been carrying out the majority of attacks. One of those attacks in on the Jordanian-Syrian border with Iraq actually killed three U.S. servicemen. And those were the first American fatalities since the Gaza war began. And of course, it's again one of those moments where everybody holds their breath and waits for the response. And President Biden has said that there will be a response from the United States. So since then, we have seen Hezbollah take a step back and announce for now the suspension of hostilities. The Iraqi government has said it is because the Iraqi government has managed to essentially calm Kataib Hezbollah down. But we all know in reality that the Iraqi government has struggled for years to rein in these actors, and that especially during times of conflict, even though, you know, parts of them are officially integrated into the security apparatus of the state and they're supposed to answer to the commander in chief, in times of conflict, that doesn't really happen. And they end up, you know, acting outside of the chain of command. So to what extent the Iraqi government actually managed to do that, I think there's a big question mark around that. Some analysts are saying that it was, in fact, Tehran that tried to pressure these groups to cool it down so that probably it wouldn't face the retaliation from the United States. But again, this is not a solution. So it's probably a temporary suspension of military activity. But what is really needed is for the international community to recognize the root causes and the grievances that are driving these actors to lash out and to address those root causes, because everything else is just going to be a band-aid solution, and you will see these conflicts, you know, bubbling up again and again over the years to come.
One potential route to de-escalation that's been suggested, including in a leader article in The Economist magazine and elsewhere, is to go back to the situation in Gaza, to those talks around hostage releases and a deal there that could somehow perhaps change the approach of Israel and then lead to negotiations towards an end to the violence and a proper ceasefire. How credible do you find that argument and that potential avenue to peace?
The hostage exchange is a start, and it's the easiest start for both sides, because it is absolutely, you know, it's a top priority for both. But it's again, you know, it's just an entry point. Ultimately, the reason why Hamas says that it carried out the attacks on October 7th, it was because of the hopelessness that Palestinians were facing, with a growing share of Palestinian land being annexed by settlers, with increasing violence in Jerusalem at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government essentially completely discarding any possibility for a Palestinian state or a two-state solution. So it was this desperation that prompted them to carry out this attack. And I think it's important to mention that, because a lot of people have been trying to say, well, no, this conflict started on October 7th, and they don't want to hear or talk about this context. And the context is not to justify Hamas's actions. I mean, it was the attacks they carried out killed more than 1,000 people, most of them civilians. They committed atrocities, potential war crimes that are still being investigated. But I think we still need to understand the why, because that is where the solution is. So I think while, you know, the hostage deal will potentially be a start, and I think exchange of hostages is one of the major reasons why Hamas carried out the attacks in the first place. You know, now there is a host of other issues that needs to be addressed. You have this massive destruction of Gaza, more than 25,000 people killed, That you hear constantly messages coming out of Israel, essentially advocating for a resettlement of Gaza. So there are just so many other issues that need to be addressed. I think the hostage negotiations are perhaps the first step, but I think Hamas also feels that, well, once we let go all the hostages, Israel will just resume. And that's why they need more. They need a concrete path to a proper settlement of all the issues that they have been raising. And if that is not done, it's difficult to see the way out of this. And I think this is where the United States and the international community is extremely important, because they need to apply pressure so that there is an actual path towards a two-state solution and towards addressing the grievances that have been afflicting Palestinians for decades.
Throughout this conflict, Qatar has also been a key kind of broker between Hamas and Israel in those early days when there, you know, was more progress on the release of Israeli hostages held in Gaza. Are they still a key player in this?
So Qatar has unique leverage over Hamas because they have been, you know, providing financial support. They have been, you know, providing diplomatic support for a really long time. So they are well positioned because they simply have the leverage and the access. And I think Hamas was quite, you know, willing to engage in these negotiations in the beginning. But I think, you know, Qatar doesn't have leverage over Israel, right? There needs to be other parties to this that bring the two sides together and really pressure them to commit by whatever they agree to. And I think the United States ultimately plays the decisive role here. If it continues to insist on Israel's right to self-defense, then that's actually seen as a carte blanche for it to continue with its current military campaign. And there is very little reason to stop or respond to any kind of offers that are coming.
How important do you think the action in the International Criminal Court is in terms of building that pressure on Israel?
That's a very good question. I think that the decision was really a landmark decision. It was really the first time that an international court recognized the plight of the Palestinians that has been going on for so long. And it essentially confirmed that it was plausible that genocide was being committed. And it also demanded that Israel report back within a month to present evidence on how it is trying to prevent genocide from taking place. So it has definitely placed some public pressure on Israel, but I think, you know, as long as Israel continues to receive billions of dollars in military aid, as long as, you know, Western governments on the same day of the ruling, rather than supporting the International Court of Justice by respecting its decision, instead decide to withdraw funding from UNRWA, it doesn't send the right message. So in terms of actually being able to force Israel to stop what is going on in Gaza, I think it will require bilateral pressure from the countries that are providing military aid, that are essentially backing Israel on the international stage. And there we have not seen that much movement.
And Simona, so tell us where else you're going next in your reporting. What are the stories that you're hoping to be looking into?
So I will be heading to Iraq in the coming days to try and see what the ripple effects are of this conflict on the country. So Iraq still has around 2,500 coalition troops who've been there since 2014 when they were invited into the country to help fight ISIS. And their presence has become more of a controversial issue since ISIS was territorially defeated in 2017. There is a sense that the main reason why those troops are in fact there is to provide a counterweight to Iran, which is Iraq's eastern neighbor, and also to prop up the Syrian democratic forces in eastern Syria, the Kurdish forces who helped the coalition fight ISIS. So there has, even until now, been quite a push to let's say, accelerate the withdrawal of American forces. And what the war in Gaza has done is that it has reinforced those demands. So what some of these groups like Kataib Hezbollah have been saying all along is that we want the American forces to leave. And with, you know, what is going on in the region now, that stance has just been hardened. It's additional proof that the presence of American troops in the region is a destabilizing factor. And in fact, the Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani has said that much at the World Economic Forum in Davos, that for Iraq to find stability, American forces need to leave so that Iraq can just have a normal bilateral relationship with the United States. And so it's very interesting now to see what will happen, because the United States does not want to withdraw under fire. Obviously, it needs to also save face and withdraw in a manner that is seen as dignified. But at the same time, there is more pressure from the Iraqi government that this withdrawal should happen sooner than later so that the situation calms down. So it's quite interesting how that will play out in the coming weeks and months.
Well, it sounds really like an important story to tell, and thank you so much for giving us all of your insights today into the still very uncertain situation in the Middle East. So Simona, thank you very much for coming.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much to Simona for joining us. If you enjoyed this podcast, then do pick up a copy of Prospect magazine to read about Simona's reporting from Lebanon. On our website and on our app, you can read all of Prospect's journalism, including historian Avi Schlaim's powerful essay on the destruction of Gaza and the historical roots of the conflict between Israel and Palestinians.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.